all companies supplying generic products and clones. Because information technology has made it possible to cater to ever tinier segments, these enterprises have been flourishing in small niches. In a number of Harvard Business Review articles, I have shown how these trends have combined in the 1990s to put obscure suppliers, often lumped together under the label other in market share pie charts, in the position of significant and fast-growing competitors. It was once conventional wisdom to assume that over time, industries inevitably consolidated, generics faded, and diversification subsided. But in fact, as dominant as Microsoft is in the PC software market, the largest market share for this product worldwide is still claimed by other. Those growing ranks of small operators, as well as large companies creating brand extensions, are deploying database segmentation and direct marketing techniques so precise as to be capable of addressing and targeting the smallest conceivable market, the market of one. Customers in their microsegments are being bombarded with promotional messages, delivered not just through familiar media such as print and network television advertisements, point-of-sale displays, talking table tents, catalogs, and phone calls, but also fax broadcasts, online flashing messages, customized newsletters, email, and in-flight commercials. Many customers are increasingly irritated by this onslaught. More and more, they switch brands with impunity, overnight. Brand new marketing, child of the information age. How, in this environment, can companies create and maintain brand loyalty? The answer is to alter brand definition so as to supply what has been missing from the picture, a rich dialogue between producers and consumers, part of the feedback loop described in Chapters 2 and 3. That producer-customer interaction, made possible by the tools of the information age, will need to have its information systems tuned to real time if companies are to coordinate and deliver finely calibrated, timely responses to consumers. As I show in the next chapter, The Real-Time Corporation, this kind of response will require a new, keen attentiveness to customers, as well as to customer-oriented investment in every sphere of corporate activity, from design to after-purchase service. Achieving closure on satisfying customer wants will be a struggle for marketing executives trying to inculcate in their organizations this real-time approach to building brand strength. Time-honored biases will die hard. A Levi Strauss manufacturing manager I once heard being interviewed defined heaven as one size fits all, only to be promptly corrected by his marketing counterpart, who offered as his own rather different definition, every size and color made for the individual. Some of today's best managed corporations are already reaping the benefits of brand dominance forged, as it will be in the future, from exemplary customer consideration, even though their success is often attributed, quite wrongly, to old-fashioned image creation. Consider Intel, for instance. In many of the articles I have read about the Intel Inside branding campaign, the success of Intel's brand is credited to the slogan and the size of the advertising budget. These articles fail to point out that Intel owned more than 80% of the microprocessor market before it began that campaign. It is not advertising, but leadership won over the course of 20 years of technology development, carefully integrating customers' needs, that made Intel a household name. The microprocessor development systems that Intel pioneered in the early 1970s helped engineers at customer companies design this customizable component into their new products more quickly and less painfully than was possible before its introduction. Taking a systems approach to product design, Intel added peripheral products and services, making the customer's job easier, allowing them to get their products to market faster. Competitors challenging Intel have long had to contend with the service-like marketing operation the company has developed, a rarity in the commodity-oriented semiconductor industry of which Intel is part. Intel's all-but-impregnable infrastructure, the assemblers, software developers, value-added resellers, and systems integrators, all of which had adopted Intel's architecture as the standard to which they fit their own products, has even made it hard for competitors with superior microprocessors to make a dent in Intel's dominant share of the market. Intel's huge investment in R&D and in production facilities also contributed to its brand strength. It out-innovated and out-invested its rivals. In the same way, the slogans we all seem to have known forever, Coke Adds Life and It's the Real Thing, have had far less to do with the power of the Coca-Cola brand than the company's biggest brand asset, its peerless worldwide distribution. P&G, held up as the ultimate authority on branding, is actually the beneficiary of generous spending on R&D and outstanding distribution that is heavily dependent on information technology to make sure that its products are always sitting on grocery store shelves right where and when customers want them. Building a supportive infrastructure takes time, and without it, brand is meaningless. America Online found that out early in 1997, when what many pundits saw as a marvelous marketing effort turned sour. AOL offered access to its online services at one low standard rate, compelling net surfers to sign up by the tens of thousands, only to find a busy signal when they tried to log on. Angry consumers filed lawsuits, government agencies forced the company to give rebates and cut advertising, and a number of users switched to other providers. The promotion worked as intended, but the company's brand suffered. New brand, high touch. Brand is so much more than a static name in an ad or on a package linked to vague associations with promises, success, or the good life. Rather, brand is an active experience, a difference I was able to explain to my wife by contrasting experiences we each had on a single day. The nature of my wife's work has made her heavily dependent on her cellular phone company, so a notification that she was about to have her service canceled came as a nasty shock that morning. It seems that her payment for her bill, which happens to be 5 times the national average, had not been received by the company. She had, in fact, paid what she owed by electronic funds transfer. To establish this, she was forced first to spend half an hour on hold waiting for a cellular company representative, and then to have our bank fax confirmation of the payment to the billing department. The cellular service was unwilling to give her the benefit of the doubt, even though a supervisor subsequently confessed that it was because the company had changed its billing codes without informing its customers that her transfer of funds had gotten stuck in electronic limbo. Coincidentally, I too had a late notice that day from American Express for a payment made electronically. I was heading out to Tokyo the next day and was concerned about not being able to use my card once I got there. As I explained all this to an American Express representative, I could hear the clicking of computer keys in the background as he looked up the history of my account. He asked where I was employed. The McKenna Group, I replied, and noted that as a very mobile consulting firm and an American Express client, we are a good customer. I vividly recall his response. "I can see that," he said. Because both my personal record and that of my firm were good, he said he would note that the payment was under dispute and should be given time to clear. "You can continue to use your card without any problems," he added. As I told my wife, the information technology behind American Express's instantaneous troubleshooting will be the key to determining the brand marketing winners and losers of the decade ahead. Exceptional service is already linked inextricably to highly responsive computer-based systems. I do not find it surprising that the chief information officers at two leaders in the use of computers for customer satisfaction, P&G and Federal Express, were promoted to their positions from marketing. Marketing management will have to become increasingly concerned with the minutiae of developing interactive information services. In fact, I believe that budgets for broadcast marketing will soon be reallocated to the information tools of interactive marketing, online connections, web TV, computer kiosks, self-service terminals, and customer call centers. A climate of innovation is transforming marketing from the ground up. Innovation, Peter Drucker says, is an economic and social term. Its criterion is not science or technology, but a change in the economic or social environment, a change in the behavior of people as consumers or producers. Businesses are likely to discover that their customers are innovating or adapting faster than they are. Ultimately, the way to build brand muscle will be for marketing to catch up with customers' reorientation, and then, as my next chapter shows, for the rest of the organization to keep up with marketing. The real-time message. Brand is a virtual experience derived from the consumer's experiences with a product, service, or company, not from the messages of broadcast media. The development of brand requires that an infrastructure of distribution, support, and service be in place when and where the consumer wants it. Real-time technology delivers the brand experience, anytime, any place. Chapter 5. The Real-Time Corporation. Real-time management will mean transforming relationships inside companies. It calls for the intimate and immediate interconnection of marketing, product development, engineering, and manufacturing. In fact, of every sphere of an organization's activity. The road to real-time management is strewn with cautionary as well as inspirational tales, and I will begin with one of the former. It relates to an experience had by Apple Computer in the mid-1990s, a time when the company was poised for a resurgence in the Intel-Microsoft-dominated personal computer marketplace. A well-known American university ordered a few thousand PowerBook computers from Apple and announced that it would give these free of charge to newly enrolled students. Apple held a major share of the higher education computer market, and the group tackling that market well understood its requirements. This group's annual forecast for the education market was combined with forecasts for all other segments of Apple's business, including sales to business and direct and retail sales. At Apple, as at other companies, the forecasts for a given year were constantly adjusted upward and downward according to various individual estimates, bonus incentives, and sales goals set by managers. Marketing and sales then estimated the total number of PowerBooks they believed could be bought in that year by adjusting the final sales forecast against historical sales goals and results. After that, the factory had to have its say, and it hardly ever believed the forecasts from the field. Its own forecast was based not just on historical production and sales numbers, but also on estimates of what it could handle, largely a function of component suppliers' lead times for delivery. As at many companies, the reconciliation of marketing and manufacturing numbers was a fractious process of guesses, estimates, alterations, debates, and compromises. In this event, Apple found itself a million units short of demand that year, with most of the shortfall consisting of PowerBooks. The university that had used the offer of a free machine as a sign-up tactic had delighted prospective students and their parents, and their reaction helped the institution to attain its enrollment goal. But now this customer had to be told that it would only get a tenth of the computers it wanted. Word came back down the chain to the Apple salesman on the spot, and then to the university officials, only a few weeks before the start of the fall semester. The head of the university called the president of Apple, demanding that he do something. PowerBooks were duly reallocated to the university, but some people somewhere else had to be severely disappointed. With Apple unable either to gauge demand accurately or to adjust marketing's optimism to manufacturing's production constraints, customer satisfaction and confidence suffered. All the brand recognition and sexy product design in the world were of little use to Apple without the reliable demand-supply balancing information system. Anyone looking for real customer demand numbers or real production capacity had nowhere in the company to go. The irony here is that Apple, as an information company, had the knowledge and the technologies for deploying an information system relating manufacturing estimates to marketing data in real time. Of course, Apple's experience is hardly unique. Many high and low tech companies continue to base their demand supply forecasts on individual judgments without the benefit of any factual information about what has been actually ordered and what factory capacity is at any particular time. Orchestrating connectivity. Marketing, in its pivotal turn of the century role as the representative and advocate of customers, has at its disposal tools of unprecedented power in their capacity to orchestrate a company's responsiveness to those customers. These tools go well beyond what has traditionally been thought of as marketing's purview. They have the power to create customer loyalty and satisfaction exceeding anything possible with the strictly promotional tools of the past. They underpin the workings of the adaptive or real-time corporation and have to be accessible throughout the extended enterprise. Their outstanding feature is connectivity. The most impressive accomplishments of computerization in business to date have been concentrated in creating a manufacturing environment characterized by shorter design cycles and flexible retooling. Marketing and sales, by contrast, have been virtually untouched by technological progress and have carried on much as they have for decades. though computers have been used to crunch sales data and to generate 5- and 10-year market forecasts, conventional forecasting has become increasingly pointless in an environment of accelerated multi-directional, unending metamorphosis, in which Netscape, for instance, has been introducing new versions of its web browser software every 4 months in its war with the powerful Microsoft, which has been developing products at an equally fast clip. Up to the late 1990s, software of comparable complexity was updated only every year or two. In companies honing their competitive edge for the 21st century, marketing has to meet the following real-time requirements. Analyze customer feedback constantly, with that feedback originating in many instances from customers closely tied to a company's operations. The high-tech pioneers of integration of this degree were Silicon Valley suppliers of subassemblies and their customers, makers of computer systems and silicon foundries turning out custom chips. Berkeley scholar Annalise Saxenian noted in 1990 that some computer systems firms in the Valley even included suppliers in their design review meetings. Act on that customer feedback, which calls for dynamic collaboration based on shared information between all of a company's departments and managerial functions, as well as its suppliers and customers. As Saxenian notes, in the case of Silicon Valley computer systems manufacturers and their suppliers, such cooperation allows the supplier to adapt its products to anticipated market changes and exposes the systems engineers to changing component technologies. Closely monitor the quality and speed of a company's responsiveness to customer feedback. The computer technology making all of this possible is only now beginning to be widely disseminated. Today, earlier generations of information processing systems and structures are actually getting in the way of real-time management. For example, a frequent observation by my friend Ali Kute, president of Formtech, an enterprise software services subsidiary of Lockheed, whose clients have included Nike and Volvo, is that surprisingly large and well-known companies are still run by a mainframe-centered managerial infrastructure. An excess of centralized control and cumbersome user-unfriendly software interfaces discourage executives from gleaning more than a fraction of the information that resides in corporate databases. Such systems are as far from real-time tools as they could possibly be. On the other hand, the client-server-based systems that have been replacing or supplementing mainframes in many corporations also present obstacles to bringing management fully up to date. If the mainframe's principal drawback was excessive centralization, the chief disadvantage of client-server networks, in which computing tasks are distributed among smaller, linked machines, with a server acting as the repository of files and programs shared by a number of client computers, is excessive fragmentation. Instead of one great big and inhibiting company database, client-server systems often spawn numerous unrelated databases that make it difficult for different departments of companies to collaborate or for data to be shared across databases. Networked computers, the connective tissue between people and information. Prototypes of real-time information systems of the future, which have the drawbacks of neither mainframes nor client-server networks, are springing up in much the same guerrilla fashion as personal computers did in large corporations in the early 1980s. For an interface, these systems borrow the World Wide Web browser format, or specifically, a collection of easy-to-use software conventions, from the so-called hypertext markup language, HTML, that allows managers to link and share information simply by clicking on words, phrases, and even photographs, videos, and animations. Effectively, in-house equivalents of the Internet, these systems are known as intranets. Easy access to pick, click, and share applications by any team or manager collaborating across an intranet came in 1995, with Sun Microsystems' introduction of the Java programming language. Java is an object-oriented language that frees users from having to concern themselves with the arcana of computer programming, such as incompatible operating systems or hardware of different machines on the network, making networking technology transparent to them. Java works as if all the software commands and translations a user needs to access specific pieces or types of information are automatically included and executed in the act of requesting them. Overall, it means that through computers, all employees can at any time get an overview of the entire company. That computers can show each employee how his or her contribution affects the organization from day to day or month to month. That hot new ideas and information can be shared with colleagues immediately. In real-time corporations, data shared on intranets will not sit around waiting to be distributed to different sections of the company, but will be made freely and dynamically available to all managers. The inventor of HTML, Doug Engelbart, who back in the 1960s conceived of network computers as the connective tissue between people and information, envisages collaborative hypertext documents in which project reports, email, and video footage, including teleconferencing snippets, are linked and easily accessible. As Ali Kouté puts it, "What's the relationship between a project schedule and the manufacturing or marketing information you need to complete it? Dynamism. That's the interesting thing about this whole generation of computing. It's about content being constantly referred to other content. Discrete elements of information, buying schedules, design documents, specifications, order forms, budgets, have to be linked to other discrete information elements to become useful." One of Ali's customers, a $4 billion corporation we will call Company Q, has begun to use a rudimentary version of this sort of information system, which joins the information resources of two historically antagonistic internal organizations, manufacturing and engineering. Before the new system was set up, the two even maintained separate and inconsistent bills of materials. This procedural divergence considerably complicated manufacturing's job of rendering the designs of the engineers manufacturable and of making sure that new products fit the company's quality standards, procurement procedures, and budgets. Senior managers would not touch this highly charged control issue for fear of curtailing the engineer's autonomy. With a newly installed web-based intranet, however, manufacturing and engineering began to look at each other's procedures and specifications and to exchange information routinely in real time. They took steps toward agreeing on a common bill of materials system. Though the old tensions have not vanished entirely, engineers are now able to plug into their designs the components that manufacturing actually uses to implement production. And manufacturing managers are able to check and see if they can make the new designs efficiently. By taking advantage of information-sharing tools of real utility, the company has altered human behavior, almost subliminally, in a way that could not have been done if it had simply ordered the battling departments to cooperate across the boundaries of their traditional compartments and antipathies. Indeed, once people get used to working in this collaborative fashion, the technology that has catapulted them into the age of real time will become just as invisible as other technological agents have throughout history. The now ubiquitous fractional horsepower motors in our vacuum cleaners, refrigerators, electric shavers, blenders, and hair dryers, for which we scarcely ever spare a thought, were not hidden inside appliances 60 years ago. They were independent devices requiring special installation and skilled deployment with the aid of specialized attachments. When intranets become as unobtrusive as miniature motors, managers with different specializations not only will be sharing information, but will effectively be working inside the same store of data. These managers might be separated by oceans and continents, and the data will be adapted to keep up with shifting events and changing inputs from second to second if need be. In effect, the boundaries of time and space that today limit the scope of work will disappear. The effects of real-time on employee interaction. The changes in the way people in corporations work, as a consequence of real-time technologies, will be taken for granted and as little remarked on as the transformative technologies that are responsible for them. What forms will these changes take? There are some hints in the findings of two researchers who have devoted years to studying how computer networks change patterns of communication in organizations. They have found, for instance, that networks encourage people to talk more frankly, and that networked groups generate more proposals for action than do teams conferring in more conventional ways. In fact, networks tend to have a democratizing effect, which suggests how real-time organizations are likely to evolve. For their study, the researchers observed groups of both high- and low-ranking employees make decisions by electronic mail and face-to-face. They concluded that the opinions of higher status people carried less clout and were paid less attention when the medium of communication was electronic mail. Networked communication is only beginning to affect the structure of the workplace. Today, formal command structures specify who reports to whom, who assigns to whom, and who has access to what information. Organizations are traditionally built around two key concepts: hierarchical decomposition of goals and tasks, and the stability of employee relationships over time. In the fully networked organization that may become increasingly common in the future, task structures may be much more flexible and dynamic. Hierarchy will not vanish, but it will be augmented by distributed lattices of interconnections. The researchers found other effects they had not anticipated. For example, the discretionary information sharing at networked organizations seems to run contrary to non-electronic behavior in organizations. Employees openly admit their ignorance to perhaps hundreds or even thousands of people. The repliers respond to requests for help from people they do not know with no expectations of any direct benefit to themselves. Respondents seem to believe that sharing information enhances the overall electronic community and leads to a richer information environment. The result is a kind of electronic altruism, quite different from the fears that networks would weaken the social fabric of organizations. Yet, even if email does bring about deep and subtle changes in organizational life, it will soon seem the most prosaic medium for corporate communication. New forms of TV-like socializing media will bind employees together inside companies even more powerfully, just as they will enrich exchanges between companies and customers. Businesses will be able to apply techniques from entertainment and deploy systems resembling TV programming over intranets and the internet, or over outside extensions of corporate communications called extranets, to educate and train employees, announce new products, hold interactive customer seminars and workshops, and collaborate with other companies. They will effectively end up with thousands of new media channels for narrowcasting to small, specific audiences, some within, some outside their corporate bounds. When is a task done? For marketing, taking its cues from customers' wants and reactions, the real-time tool with the most radical benefits has to do with measurement. Virtually every company in business for a few years has had the experience of introducing a new product or service that failed, and of discovering, in analyzing its lack of success, that it did not incorporate features that market intelligence and market managers had, at the start, described as essential to market acceptance. Somewhere between marketing's listing of requirements and the product or service launch, the details were lost or ignored, or compromises unacceptable to marketing managers were made without their knowledge. There was, in fact, no checklist or measure of doneness, the degree to which marketing specifications were acted on. In fact, when people in companies say they are done, they have often met only 2/3 or less of their own criteria for completing a job, whether the work concerned has to do with engineering, financial, or marketing management. The real-time solution to this problem is to begin by setting up a project database into which is fed all the linked deadlines and other performance goals of every member of the team assembled for the exercise. At any stage, any manager from any department can access the schedule of progress at higher or lower levels of detail and get real-time information about where things stand. An executive can see when some procedure or system is not working and take corrective action, which may even include training employees in skills they have been found to lack. Even more important in certain businesses is the option of allowing customers to make similar verifications for themselves. For example, checking the status of an order by logging onto a company's order management computer network. Federal Express put such a system in place in November 1994, allowing customers on the World Wide Web to track their own shipments on the FedEx package tracking database. As Ali Kouté sees it, one of the interesting things about this automation is that it forces people to go back and think about their business processes. What's the definition of done? Have you done the quality checks? Have you done enough testing? And so on. What companies discover as they go about this exercise is that the same employees who define what done is themselves fail to execute the necessary steps involved, but the system draws attention to their oversights. All of a sudden, companies are getting real-time information about what is actually happening in their organizations. They don't get nasty surprises 6 months later when maybe customers call and say, "What is this? Take it back, fix it," or whatever. This sort of capability will be indispensable to the company that wants to keep track of its constant adaptations to customer wants and demands, to monitor the unending process of communication, action, and evaluation that goes on within the closed-loop system that is the real-time corporation. Information moves from the market to customer service and marketing to product development and manufacturing, and then back out again to the company's family of customers and suppliers. Feedback and self-service are the touchstones of the real-time corporation. Although no single company has yet completed the transition to real-time management, several have negotiated important early stepping stones. Intuit. Realizing that the ultimate goal of real-time management is to give customers the means to satisfy themselves, Intuit, the personal finance software specialist, introduced a product-service hybrid designed to speed customer satisfaction. Quicken Live, related to Intuit's best-selling personal finance software package Quicken, contains additional software, an online connection, and a browser. At the click of a button, users get onto the Quicken network and are instantly able to customize the program to their wants or needs. Because the 10 million Quicken users can serve themselves, they derive satisfaction in real time, sharply reducing Intuit's customer support costs. Ideas for changes in applications come from a well-established feedback loop. Walmart. At Walmart, which has divided the United States into 17 sales regions but has no regional sales offices, regional managers travel through their territory every week, meeting store managers, observing shoppers, and visiting competitor stores. Every Thursday, they gather around a table at corporate headquarters in Bentonville, Arkansas, to discuss what they have seen and heard, and to go over the analyses of sales data gathered from checkout scanners all over the country every day. On Fridays, they go on the company's private television network with all the store managers to plan the following week. Microsoft. At Microsoft, where, according to Bill Gates, 80% of product improvements are based on customer feedback, software developers listen in on calls from buyers of the products they have designed to gather unfiltered reactions from the marketplace. There is a built-in penalty for listening in but failing to respond appropriately. To get the attention of our product group managers, Gates has explained, we charge their departments for the cost of providing technical support to customers who use their products. Boston Chicken. Two prototypes being tested at Boston Market, the chain of fast food stores owned by Boston Chicken, are a real-time employee feedback system and a customer feedback channel found on in-store kiosks. At the end of each shift, employees punching out on time clocks are encouraged to tap into computers to answer questions designed to ensure that they find their work fun and rewarding. Their replies remain confidential, and store managers see a weekly analysis of the strengths and weaknesses of their branches. In the customer kiosk system, a touchscreen computer terminal sits beside store exits. Boston Chicken hopes customers on their way out the door will complete a 30-second survey of their opinions on the food, service, hygiene, and so on. The premise behind both systems is that the freshest information is the most valuable. The company's early appreciation of the importance of real-time feedback and the systems to support it could explain why its founding president, J. Bruce Herold, was appointed Senior Vice President of Strategy at IBM in 1995. Federal Express. Federal Express has been teaching its customers the skills they need to serve themselves. The company estimates that each year it trains an average of 500,000 users of its self-service PowerShip system, installed either on PCs it supplies to corporate customers for their use or on machines of their own. Most of these are not end users, but companies using FedEx to serve customers of their own. As noted above, in one of the most recent stages of the company's progression to real-time operation, FedEx has been allowing everyone, including end customers, to log onto its database through the World Wide Web. Kennametal. One of my favorite comeback stories concerns a steel company in a small town 50 miles east of Pittsburgh that extended information technology to its customers to resurrect the business. Kennametal is the dominant industry in Latrobe, home of golfing great Arnold Palmer, and where I happened to attend college for a few years. The company manufactures tools and products for the metalworking, mining, and highway construction industries. Like many of the basic steel companies in America, Kennametal fell on tough competitive times in the 20 years leading up to the 1980s. At that time, they began investing seriously in information technology, and consequently emerged in the 1990s as one of America's most successful high-tech, low-tech companies. A New York Times article in 1992 reported, "Kennametal's information systems have more in common with trendsetters in retailing, banking, and transportation than those of most of its peers. They spent 3 years developing an information system so managers and customers could find out in seconds what products are available to them at their sites around the country." Little wonder the company's very profitable revenues grew from $618 million in 1992 to more than $1 billion in 1996. It's possible to reach critical mass without mass confusion. There is no question that the many and vast transformations that real-time technologies ask of organizations are paralyzing the managers of many companies, who seem much like deer caught in blazing headlights. It is not always easy to apply the embryonic technologies of real time. Computers have been in factories for decades, yet the ideal of the virtual factory, tens or hundreds of networked production facilities dividing labor so that each one does only what it does best, effectively working together as a single well-oiled machine, remains hard to realize. As David Upton and Andrew McAfee point out in their essay, "The Real Virtual Factory," it is one thing for a networked factory to be possible or desirable, and it is quite another to create and maintain it and help it evolve. Designing the system, administering it, updating its technology, maintaining security, and exploiting new opportunities as they arise are collectively a huge job, and one that companies whose primary business is not IT will be loath to undertake. Yet once companies summon the will to tackle the job, their appetite for the new capabilities fast becomes ravenous, not to mention hugely contagious. Upton and McAfee offer the example of McDonnell Douglas Aerospace, which, with the help of a spin-off information broker, Aerotech, built its virtual factory. The number of participants in this computer-linked manufacturing community has soared since mid-1993, when Aerotech began adding external suppliers to the network. Until then, the network had been limited to 50 or so McDonnell employees who used it to pass data between different computer systems within the organization. When external suppliers joined, they were so impressed with the way the network helped them work with McDonnell that they started to ask their suppliers and partners to join. By the fall of 1994, there were 400 internal and external users. There are now several thousand. This sort of sudden rash of implementation is very much of the hour, even if it is preceded by years of extreme technological conservatism. In other cases, senior managers who resist change for too long are likely to be rocketed into the next evolutionary stage by the sort of bottom-up revolution that brought swarms of personal computers into companies nearly two decades ago. Already, young, web-savvy software engineers and managers in slow-moving big companies are writing programs in the web's HTML language, and they are even using these programs to create new, easier-to-use front ends for retrieving data from the corporate mainframe computers. They are ignoring aging official company software and beginning to do their jobs with the help of brand new and free applications programs downloaded from the net, like those in Netscape's Applications Foundry, for everything from human resources to financial management. Many are using unfinished applications programs, prototypes riddled with bugs, having come to the correct conclusion that given the wildly accelerating pace of change, a polished bug-free software product is likely to be a polished bug-free obsolete software product. As much as this web-inspired insurrection is helping employees to streamline their particular tasks, it is also causing the sort of operational chaos that the PC infiltration did. But then, chaos attends all new beginnings, all births, all genuine creativity and innovation. The advent of the real-time corporation is no exception to this rule. The real-time message. The task of implementing a real-time corporation is difficult and complex, but it is an essential investment in your competitive future. The implementation of real-time systems will have the effect of changing the working relationships within your organization, as well as those with your partners and customers. The application of the technology will change your corporate culture. As these systems are adopted, new ideas for services and products, new ways of gaining customer loyalty, and new methods of team collaboration will take shape. Then, information technology will indeed become a valued corporate asset. Chapter 6. Continuous, Discontinuous Change. The transition to real-time operation has begun to churn up huge creative chaos inside corporations, and this has its counterpart on the outside. In business in general, as in society at large, the run-up to the millennium is being marked by acute discontinuities and trends. On the inside of their organizations, managers operating at warp speed will come to understand the operational non sequitur as norm. On the outside, the business environment as a whole, they will experience jarring, large-scale shifts in perspective, orientation, and practice. Managers' ability to understand and adapt to these five kinds of discontinuity will be essential for success in their organizations in the age of real time. 1. From economies of scale to economies of time. 2. From broadcast to access, or monologue to dialogue. 3. From data content to people content. 4. From fixed boundaries to open space. 5. From the satisfied to the self-satisfied consumer. From economies of scale to economies of time. The noted physicist Freeman Dyson advises, never sacrifice economies of time for economies of size. That is an idea with crucial implications for business today. For the past quarter century, driven on the one hand by advancing technology and on the other by intensifying competition, business has been compressing design, manufacturing, and distribution times. Technology serves the insatiable appetite for speed and innovation, productivity improvement, and cost cutting. No company even halfway attentive to its market is allowed to forget that speed is value. Consumers have grown to like speed, as I said in Chapter 1. The shopping center, grocery store, TV, computer, workplace, and the neighborhood have served as subliminal classrooms, educating consumers to demand satisfaction now. Technology is what helps winners to get to market first, and the tools of time compression span a vast range, from FedEx delivery and ATMs to handheld inventory scanners and online distribution centers. A global real-time communications infrastructure with satellites as its principal building blocks is emerging as the technological key to acceleration in the future. Hewlett-Packard, one of the world's leading suppliers of computer products and information systems, a $40 billion company growing at slightly more than 20% per year, supplies valuable clues to how businesses will profit from all of this. Joel Birnbaum is a senior vice president of R&D for the company and director of HP Labs. He told me, "We're very much driven by time to market, and it's forced us to run our business quite differently. We seldom have the luxury of reassembling the teams to all be in the same place or even in the same country. Product development often involves combinations of divisions from France to California and elsewhere. Even so-called simple products like our inkjet printers require global teams, so we've had to learn how to work at a distance. We have been using TCP/IP, Internet Data Communications Protocols, since 1983, when I installed the first networks and the first VAX machine in HP Labs. There was no rule against buying a competitor's product, but people said to me, 'Gosh, right near Dave Packard's office, you're going to put in a DEC-10 and a couple of VAXes?' I told Dave why these were needed and the advantages of collaboration on design around the world, and he agreed. I also told him, one of these days, we'll have a bonfire in the parking lot, and we'll burn all the Vaxes as soon as we have the horsepower to replace them with our own machines. Actually, we could have done that a few years ago. That was the beginning of our connecting servers to distributed design operations using TCP/IP. Today, our internal internet traffic exceeds 7 to 8 trillion bytes per month. We send about 1.6 million emails a day on TCP/IP networks inside the organization. We have 130,000 computer hosts around the world serving 112,000 employees. In a business where 77% of our revenue comes from products introduced in the past 2 years, we see real-time communication and collaboration as a competitive asset. Hewlett-Packard has helped shape the modus operandi of Silicon Valley, where companies are always on the edge of the future, making it happen, rather than drafting elaborate prognostications about it. Growth forecasts, such as 5- and 10-year projections for product sales, are routinely ignored because they are seen as mere extrapolations from history. Instead, people are in constant touch with the technological and competitive environment of the moment. Change is treated as an opportunity that, if spotted ahead of competitors and acted on as fast as possible, can transform the ranking of companies in an industry virtually overnight. The advantages of industry leadership can vanish in a flash. Decisions are made in tight collaborative networks, and mistakes corrected as fast as they are spotted. Speed is our differentiation, says Mike Homer, the vice president of Netscape. Speed does not allow for much planning, or for the leisurely deployment of decision-making tools such as opinion polls, surveys, and focus groups on which managers once relied for security and a sense of direction. The improvisational Silicon Valley style of management is perfectly adapted to the chaotic changes characteristic of transitional eras like this one. Silicon Valley also supplies the clearest examples of the penalties paid for delayed reaction. In February 1996, for instance, I met with Gil Amelio, newly appointed chief executive of Apple Computer, on his second day with the company. I volunteered my recommendations for reversing Apple's declining fortunes, among them to get operating costs down, to outsource manufacturing, to license Java, and to work on rebuilding relationships with third-party software developers. Above all, I said, he must act quickly to implement a shortlist of critical changes within the first quarter of his watch. Patience is not a characteristic of today's marketplace. He shook his head, insisting that the turnaround would take 3 years. 1 year after he took over, both Apple's share of the personal computer market and its stock price had declined 40%, and software developers were abandoning the Macintosh platform in droves. Without prompt evidence of his intention to effect sweeping changes at the company's core, the world outside Apple lost confidence in its prospects in a widening ripple effect. Like forces of nature or acts of God, technological and market forces move so rapidly and the warning signs of change are so subtle that managers more often than not fail to see them or their effects coming. Porsche lost 80% of its U.S. market share in just 5 years in the early 1990s. In 1995, an unscrupulous young trader making unsanctioned derivative investments from his computer console in Singapore brought about the fall of Barings, the 100-year-old British financial institution. Only one-third of the companies on the Fortune 500 list at mid-century still survive today. More than half of the top 20 computer companies in the United States were not in business 20 years ago. Now, as time flies, much that is familiar and seemingly rock solid flies out the window with it. Everywhere today, the change-resistant are rapidly taught the error of their ways. John Akers, the erstwhile chairman and chief executive officer of IBM, had planned a strategic redirection of the company in 1993. But in the wake of several quarters of sliding revenue growth and years of declining competitive standing, Wall Street and powerful institutional investors did not give him the chance to implement his ideas. As a result of his relative tardiness in plotting his reorganization, he was forced out of his job within months of his plan's conception. From broadcast to access, or monologue to dialogue. Broadcast means the dissemination of the same information to everyone in pre-digested form. Access means that consumers choose what information they want.